Blog Talk Radio.
Who's that lady?
Anna!
Stop, listen, it's a Rand McCoy show. Stop, listen, it's a Rand McCoy show. Who's that lady?
Anna!
The Rand McCoy! Stop, listen, it's a Rand McCoy show. Stop, listen, it's a Rand McCoy show. Who's that lady?
Anna!
The Rand McCoy!
Hurry, come and listen, it's a Rand McCoy show.
Hurry, come and listen, it's a Rand McCoy show. Hurry,
who's
come and listen,
lady?
It's a Rand McCoy show.
Anna!
The Rand McCoy!
Hurry, come and listen, it's a Rand McCoy show.
Hurry, come and listen, it's a Rand McCoy show. Hurry,
who's
come and listen, it's a Rand McCoy show.
Anna!
The Rand McCoy!
Well, welcome to the show. This is Anna, the Real McCoy. You're listening to Woman Act Now Radio. And today I am absolutely excited by having a friend who is joining us, What to Do When Your Money is Funny, with our guest author, Lee Jenkins. I mean, this man is extraordinary. He is just, listen, if you have a church, a ministry, or an organization, and you want to empower individuals on financial empowerment, you need to call Lee Jenkins and you need to listen to the show. Because you know what? We're in a time in our economy, everything is tightening, it's getting more difficult to get credit, we've got the mortgage crunch, but today's guest is going to help us because you know what? Our money is funny. And our guest and author, Lee Jenkins, is going to help us and help us figure out how to manage our finances in this economy, and he's going to be talking about some great things from his book, and I want you to join us, so I want to welcome Lee Jenkins to the show.
Hey, Anna, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Lee. How are you doing today?
I am wonderful. God is good, and I'm excited about talking to you today.
Well, let me tell you something, Lee. We had your friend Deborah Winans on the show last week.
Yes.
And, in fact, we were talking about you on that show last week and that we were going to be talking with you today, and what a blessing you've been in her life.
Yes.
And you knew her because she actually, we were talking about how you relationships and how you guys knew each other when y'all was both broke.
That's exactly right. I mean, very broke. Couldn't even pay attention back in those days, let alone pay the bills.
Yeah, well, hopefully, and right now, we're in a much better place in our lives, all of us. I told her, at least I didn't have that privilege of knowing you so far back where we didn't have anything when I had the opportunity of meeting you. We were able to go around and work together with the JBAZ event and empower individuals and,
yes,
you know, taking responsibility for their financial lives. So I'm really excited about your presence today because on in our organization, Woman Act Now, one of the things that we've focused on is throughout this entire month we have focused on finances,
mm-hmm,
helping women to understand how to position themselves, how to deal with their finances, how to, improve their credit scores. But all of these have been the issues of the day for the month of July as it relates to financial execution. So I want you to begin to talk to us about, what's your book all about? What's What to Do When Your Money is Funny all about?
Well, thank you for asking. Well, Anna, it's amazing that I wrote this book about a year and a half or so ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I use the title, What to Do When Your Money is Funny, because that's just a slang word that people use when their money is not right or when they desire more financially or when they are going through some financial adversity. And little did I know a year and a half ago as I was putting this book together that by the time the book came out, we would really be in one of the worst, if not the worst, financial crisis this nation has ever seen. I didn't know at the time I was writing this book that home values would be declining. And we were always taught if you invested in a home or bought a home, that that was the most secure investment a person could make.
Yeah.
Well, over the last year and a half, it's been the first time in this country that home values have fallen 10, 15, 20%, in some places 30 or 40%. Of course, we have gas prices are at an all-time high. We have food prices. We have a bad stock market. People are getting laid off. And so this book addresses just common issues that everyday people face when it comes to their money. And I did it in a question and answer format.
Okay.
Because I speak all around the nation, Anna, like you do, and many times after I speak, I open it up for a Q&A session.
Yes.
And I found out that no matter where I go, most people have the same questions.
Okay.
And so I divided the book up into like 11 different chapters, budgeting and spending, automobiles, credit, debt, giving, romance and finance, real estate and mortgages, life insurance, estate planning, adults and young adults and children. And I just came up with the top 15 or 20 most commonly asked questions that people have. And I answered the questions for them in a biblical and practical, from a biblical and practical standpoint.
All right. Well, let's start. Let's start and let's take some of those questions from the book that you have, and you can begin to answer that. So let's start with the area of I really like talking about relationships, because I believe that as we are in relationship with others, and that's not just our relationship with our spouses, but it's also our relationship with our children, as well as our partners in business, and, you know, just relationships all around. And talk to share some of those questions with us and then give us some advice.
Well, the first relationship, well, let me back up a little bit. This book, obviously, we want people to realize that they should have a relationship with Jesus Christ.
Okay.
And so what we do is I come up at the beginning of the book, Anna, and I talk about some of the reasons why a person's money could be funny.
Okay.
And basically, I just talk about issues like spiritual warfare, or issues like God could be allowing this to happen in our lives to strengthen us and to discipline us and things like that. So I try to encourage people who may be going through some things that, hey, just because you're struggling financially or going through something, that's not the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
5 years from now, 2 years from now, 6 months from now, you may look back on this and say, wow, no wonder that happened. And so hopefully this will cause a relationship with Christ to be stronger.
Okay.
But I do have a whole chapter, Anna, about romance and finance,
okay,
which deals with the relationships between, you know, men and women, and how to deal with money together as a couple. I also deal with a chapter on with young adults and how we should deal with our children and so forth. You want me to just kind of mention one of my questions in here?
Sure. Well, I have a question for you.
Okay.
It may not necessarily be specific to one in your book.
Okay.
But here's a question that we had. Is this question has to do with financial planning and also just some common money management, you know. The question was, we are newlyweds, just starting our financial journey together. What advice do you have to help us avoid financial pitfalls?
Wow. That is a very, very good question, and that's one of the questions that I deal with here in this book. And it's a commonly asked question, is, you know, how do we deal with this this issue? Well, I would say first of all, a lot of problems that couples have about money, particularly in marriage, many of these issues should be handled before they get married,
mm-hmm.
And we should ask questions like, what are your financial assets and liabilities? In other words, when we meet someone and it gets pretty serious, you need to know something about what they owe and what they have. You need to know their credit scores. Are they a tither? What are their financial aspirations? What are their goals? What are your career expectations? How are we going to divide up our financial duties? In other words, who's going to pay the bills? And are we going to operate from one checkbook or two checkbooks? What about family members that ask us for money? You know, how are we going to deal with that? So I would say, Anna, to answer your question, the number one thing that people need to do is to get on the same page. And the only way to get on the same page is you have to ask each other some tough questions,
mm-hmm.
and sit down and battle it out, so to speak, as to what is the right thing to do.
Well, let's talk about some of the, what are some of the mistakes that most people, whether they're married for a long time in, you know, partnership relationships, because we have a lot of people who are not necessarily married, but they do share a lot of financial, you know, monies, and, you know, they share that. They have accounts together. They have credit cards together, partnering relationships, or whatever the case may be. But what are some of the mistakes, some of those common mistakes that people make?
Okay. As it relates to relationships?
Yes, as it relates to relationships.
Okay. Well, I would say the first common mistake is they let love blind them to the realities of life. Okay. Now, what do I mean? And I'm going to say they let love blind them to the realities of their financial life.
Yeah,
you
okay,
see,
that's good.
Yeah, and what do I mean by that? Well, we love each other, so everything is just going to work out fine. It doesn't matter if he has bad credit. Oh, it doesn't matter if he didn't pay his credit cards. That was in the past. Our financial character really can impact our marriage, And so it is very important that a potential husband and wife know as much as they can about their spouse-to-be's financial character.
Okay.
Because that says a lot about their true character. Mm. So that's one mistake they make. They just don't do their homework, or they tend to let their love for the person just override all of that financial stuff. Now, that doesn't mean a person has to have a perfect financial background, because most of us don't.
Yes, you know, you remember my testimony of when we were on the JBass tour is that I married good credit.
That's right.
I told my sweetheart, don't put my name on it. When we went to buy the first house, I said, listen, you don't want to put my name on it, okay?
Yeah.
So although I understand what you're saying about your financial character, and mine certainly wasn't at its best at that time, and I didn't bother telling a brother that was so in love with me, by the way. I led him down the altar blind until he said, I do, and when he said, I do, and I said, well, I don't have no good credit. So you can go ahead and share another couple of those failures, those mistakes that we make.
Okay. Well, another mistake that couples make is they hide money from one another. They operate on, well, this is my money, this is your money, and they aren't on the same page. Now, you may say, well, I know a lot of couples that have been quite successful at doing that. Well, in my book, I talk about you may be successful doing that, but when you handle your money completely separately all the time. Now, there's nothing wrong with a separate account as long as there's full disclosure.
Yeah.
In other words, I don't think a wife and or a husband ought to have two or three accounts out there that the spouse doesn't know about.
Right.
But so there's nothing wrong with autonomy as long as there's transparency.
Okay.
But the problem comes is when a lot of women, especially black women, whose mothers have been burned by maybe their husband, and they tell their daughters, like my mother-in-law told my wife, look, honey, always keep you some on the side, because in case that joker don't act right, you know, you'll have you something.
Yeah.
And so what it does, it puts almost a distrust in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So I deal with this issue, is it wrong to hide money from your spouse?
Mm-hmm.
And the issue is, yes, but it's not wrong to have some autonomy as long as you have transparency in the relationship.
Yes. Well, you know, a couple of shows ago, we talked about financial infidelity, and that certainly leads to your point that financial infidelity can be as devastating on a marriage as sexual infidelity.
Right.
And some of those things that you're talking about, these mistakes, are often some of those blinders that occur when we're actually committing financial infidelity in the marriage.
That's
now,
right.
I'd like to switch my topic or my flow of questioning to the credit score. We talked a little bit about that, but I want to hear from an expert, and I'm sure you might have dealt with that, because I do have a question here that says, while recently applying for a loan, the lender mentioned my credit score. What is a credit score, and what does it tell the lender about me?
Wow. A credit score is a three-digit number that ranges from, you know, roughly 400 or so up to close to 900. And it basically is a snapshot at a particular time of your financial reputation. In other words, it tells that lender whether or not you have paid your bills on time, whether or not you have a whole bunch of debt, whether or not you have a short history or a long history, and they sum you up financially based on that credit score. Now, I tell people all the time, Anna, I'm not saying the credit scoring system is fair, because you can be a good person who've made some legitimate mistakes and have a bad credit score. It doesn't mean you're a deadbeat because you have a bad credit score. But the fact of the matter is, the way the system is, that's what they judge you on. So here's the bottom line. The higher your credit score, the more they will think of you. In other words, the easier it will be for you to get a loan, that you will get a better rate on the loan, and you will just be looked at more favorably. The lower your credit score, the harder it would be for you to get a loan, the higher your interest rate would be, and you won't be looked upon favorably. Not only from a loan standpoint, Anna, but they now look at credit scores when they're getting ready to hire people for certain jobs, car insurance, house insurance, cell phones, all kind of stuff. Unfortunately, it's becoming one of the standards that people use in business. So it's an important issue.
Sure. So now let's talk about from that same area of credit scores. How do we improve our credit score? Because I got an email actually on yesterday, and the young lady was actually wanting to buy a home, and she had a self-financing, you know, owner financing, and with a two-year balloon payment at the end of that. And my answer to her is, what is your credit score? She said, my credit score is a 600 right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not very good.
Nope.
So my concern for her was, how do we help her to improve her credit score over these next 2 years, and does 24 months matter, and would that be enough time for her perhaps to increase that score to a more acceptable level where a lender would want to lend her money to be able to pay for that balloon payment in 2 years?
That's a great question, Anna, and my answer to that is 2 years is enough time.
Okay.
But let me tell you what needs to happen within that two-year period. First of all, the credit score is comprised of a couple of different things that you need to do, and the better these things are, the higher your credit score will be, and the worse these things are, the lower your credit score will be. For instance, the best thing a person can do if they want to increase their credit scores is to pay their bills on time.
Yes.
And so every time you are 30 days late, even if it's one day late, you've just injured your credit score.
Mm-hmm.
So I know people who have money, but for some reason they pay their bills late.
They
so,
don't have no stamps.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Maybe they didn't put a stamp on the letter.
Right.
And I tell people, you know what, you can pay your bills online now. I tell people that. So here are a couple of things, Anna. First of all, you mentioned 2 years. It does take time. There is no quick fix. And anybody that promises you that, it's a scam. So paying your bills on time is the most important thing. So if she could go 2 years paying all of her bills, never being late, that will help her. Secondly, is she needs to lower her debt. And lowering her debt means there's a thing called debt-to-credit limit ratio. That's a fancy word for just meaning if you have $1,000 that Visa says that you can charge on your card and you've already charged $800 on it, that means your debt-to-credit ratio is 80% because you've used up 80% of your available credit.
Yeah.
Well, 80% is high, and that lowers your credit score. So the lower, if you have a credit card, you really don't want to be any more than 35% into that credit line. So if it's $1,000, you really want to try to keep those charges about $350 or less. So how do you improve your credit score? Making sure you pay some of that debt down, getting it under 50%, preferably 35%.
6% or less. So in the next 2 years, if she has credit cards that are maxed out, close to being maxed out, she needs to get them down, pay some of them off.
Now, what about also, for instance, oftentimes, even though she's kind of buying this home and moving into a new home, we tend to want to buy new things. Mm-hmm. How is that going to – that certainly wouldn't help her if she were going out to solicit new credit, correct?
Yes, that's a great point, because that's another thing. You can new accounts and recent applications for credit, that can hurt you. But it really depends on what kind of credit. If they see that you go to a department store, two or three department stores, and all of a sudden you have all these different cars that you just got, that's not a good deal. But if they see where you just got a car loan, that's not looked at that bad. So it depends on what type of new credit. Unfortunately, a lot of people go to furniture places, they go buy all this stuff, and it really hurts them. So no, and I don't know, Anna, if I answered your question, but if you don't want to, if you're trying to improve your credit, you don't want to go out and get a lot of new credit, especially if it's, department store type stuff. Now, a lot of people, I just have to throw this one other point. There's another point that's really important, and that is your length of credit.
Okay.
And the reason that's important is because some people, Anna, they pay off their credit cards and they close them. Well, if they've had that credit card for 10 years and they've paid faithfully on it, and the good Lord blesses them and they can pay it off, And they're so happy that they've paid it off, because they say, well, now I'm going to look pretty good to this lender. I'm going to pay this thing off, and I'm going to close it. Well, when you pay it off, that's good, but when you close it, that's not good. But the reason it's not good is because you just wiped out a 10-year history.
Yeah.
And the longer your history, the better, if it's a good history. So we have to be careful about closing certain types of credit card accounts.
Okay. Now, I'm going to what I'd like to talk about is talking about debt.
Okay.
Because I recall even when we were on the tour, you did just such a tremendous job in sharing with people how to get out of debt and how to recognize debt and deal with it. And one of the questions I have here is, what can I do if I feel as though I'm drowning in debt? What are some of the symptoms of a person who may be drowning in debt?
Well, some of the symptoms are worry, anxiety. Another symptom is you are maxed out on everything. Another symptom is you're paying only the minimum balance. So when the bill comes in and you may owe $5,000, but that minimum payment is $40, and that's all you can pay, which is really hard to get ahead just paying the minimum balance. How about this, robbing Peter to pay Paul, where you take money from over here to pay over here, just the whole juggling thing. So all of those are symptoms. And another symptom is when you have so much debt that you have to live off of debt. I mean, you're using the credit card for everything.
So your balances are continually increasing.
That's right. Your balances are increasing. You're not paying any of it down, and it's mainly because you're paying the minimum payment. So what does a person do? I mean,
yes.
When they're
well, that is a question. So what are my options now? Okay, I'm drowning in debt. You know, I'm not getting any. I applied for credit. Nobody's giving me any more credit. I'm doing all these things you said. You know, I'm full of anxiety. I'm maxed out. I can't do anything, Lee.
Yeah.
So what are my options? What can I do? Can I file for bankruptcy? Can I negotiate my credit? What can I do, man?
Oh,
I need some help.
That's a great question. Well, let me mention the bankruptcy thing. Too many people, they want to get out quick, they want to get out fast, they want the pressure off of them, and they use bankruptcy as an option. And I'm telling you, 8 out of 10 times, if not 9 out of 10 times, that's a huge mistake.
Tell us why, though.
Well, because it's going to stay on your record for 10 years.
Okay.
Okay, so that's going to make it even that much more. You're talking about a stigma that you're going to have to deal with for a long time. Why treat a short-term situation, if it is a short-term situation, with a long-term and have long-term consequences? So I'm just saying that most people, and I'm not saying all people, because I know things happen. People get laid off. People die. People get sick. People get disabled. People get divorced. These are catastrophic events that happen in people's lives, and they're left with all this debt, and I can understand how bankruptcy would be a viable option. But Anna, I'm telling you, I do a lot of financial counseling. 7 out of 10, if not 8 out of 10 bankruptcies that I see,
mm-hmm.
most of those people should not have filed for bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
They were just under pressure, looking for a way out, and weren't willing to go through the pain to and the discipline to do it. So here are a few things they need to do.
Okay.
The first thing is you got to find some money. In other words, if you're living paycheck to paycheck, you can't pay your bills, there are a couple of things that need to happen. Either you need to make more money, so an extra job. I mean, this is not deep stuff I'm getting ready to say. Say, starting a business on the side, whatever. You may need to find some money, meaning that I know people, Anna, who get $2,000-$3,000 tax refunds, okay? But they struggle to pay their monthly bills. Well, that doesn't make any sense, because that means that the government is holding on to your money. So why not up your withholding allowances so you can get an extra couple of $100 a month and pay down your bills rather than waiting once a year to get some kind of windfall, which most people blow anyway. So there are just things to do. So you need to either find a way to cut some of their expenses or to make more money. Now, so that, there are a lot of things, but that's the main thing, and they need to get on some kind of budget to make sure they aren't wasting money. But secondly, Anna, most importantly, call these creditors. Mm-hmm. Negotiate with them.
So you said that credit negotiation, but one of the things I heard is 50% of the people, are you saying that when we call credit to negotiate our credit, we're actually calling the actual creditor? Or this is after it actually reaches the, where you have a collection company?
Well, if it's going to the collection company, it's too late. Now, let me talk about two scenarios. Let's just say when you feel like it's getting hard and you can't pay your bill, even if you see right now where, you know what, I don't think I'm going to be able to pay this thing, that's your sign that you should call up the creditor. I'm having trouble. That's what you tell them. I lost my job. This or this. Can you all give me better terms, lower my rate, extend the term, make my minimum payment lower? You know what? 90% of the time, they'll work with you. Sometimes they'll even give you, say, you don't have to pay the next 3 or 4 months. Now, they may tack some extra payments on at the end of the loan.
Yeah.
But I'm saying the biggest mistake, Anna, people make is they get embarrassed, they get ashamed, and they do what Adam and Eve did. They go hide instead of dealing with it. So I would say, first of all, call the creditor. Now, if it's already gone to the collection agency, that's a problem. Because collection agencies, the best thing you could do with them is you can negotiate a settlement.
Okay. So now, can you hold up for one moment and explain to us about how the actual collection company works, because I've had situations where a lot of people will try to go back to the original company and try, once it's gone to the collection agency, they try to go back to the original company that then the creditor tells, well, I can't do anything for you because I don't have that account, and they don't always understand. What does that mean?
All right, that means the collection agency has bought that account from the creditor. Okay, let's just say you owed ABC Company $1,000, okay, and you haven't paid them. And they turn it over to a collection agency, and that collection agency tries to get that money from you, and they have already cut a deal with the creditor. They bought it from them. So in other words, that creditor is right. They don't own that account anymore. They've sold that bad debt to somebody else. And now the collection agency's job is to collect that $1,000 or a portion of it. And they will use almost any kind of tactic to do so. So I hate to say this, Anna, but when creditors say that, they're telling the truth most of the time, that they actually, it's out of their hands.
And so now that person is now forced to actually deal with that collection company. And at the end of the day, we are still accountable to that particular debt, whether it's with our original creditor or it's with a collection company, correct?
That is correct. But I would still encourage the people to try to beg, to plead that original company, with that original company, to work out something with them. But I'm just saying, Adam, a lot of times that's not possible, meaning that they have already turned it over. Yeah. But if they can do it, it would be better to deal with them versus the collection agency.
Okay, and we just wanted to make sure that we share with our listeners that it's important in any way, any fashion, any form, is that you negotiate every opportunity that you can.
Yeah.
Regardless to who you owe money to. And one of the things that I say, that interest is the biggest expense we will ever pay in our lives, and whether it's the interest we pay on debt, that is going to be the biggest expense. It's not the product that we purchased. It's what we paid for it in addition to getting that product, and that's usually interest. So you want to negotiate that interest in any way that you can. Now, I want to talk about a couple of other things that are currently going on in the marketplace right now that perhaps you can speak to, Lee, and that is I want to talk about, just from the perspective, what does it mean when we hear that there's a credit crunch going on in the economy?
Okay. And a few years ago, companies that extended credit, mortgage companies, just about anybody that would loan you money, their standards were very low. In other words, you could have bad credit and get a loan. Okay. Your rate may be high, but they would take chances on you. That's where the whole word subprime mortgage comes from. It's a mortgage that's subprime, meaning that it's not a prime mortgage. It's extended to someone who has bad credit or, you know, a checkered past or whatever. So a credit crunch means that now credit is difficult to get.
Okay.
So 2 years ago, if Susie Doe was, who had average to below average credit, was trying to get a $200,000 mortgage on a home, she probably could have gotten it pretty easily. Now, Susie Doe can't get that mortgage. So now it's harder for people to get in homes and to get a loan. And that really kind of hurts the economy, because now you don't have people buying homes as much, and when they don't buy homes, they don't buy refrigerators, they don't buy toasters, they don't buy furniture, and it all hurts the economy. So that's a credit crunch, is when people are not open to extending credit.
Okay. And now, does that differ in any way from a mortgage crunch? Because we've heard both of those terms being heavily used in our current, you know, business news, economic news. Those are the terms that we're hearing. So is there a difference between those?
Not really. A mortgage crunch is just, it's hard to get a mortgage. A credit crunch is hard to get a loan, hard to get any kind of credit. For instance, if a person was starting a business right now and they were trying to get a business loan, it's harder to get a business loan than it was 3 years ago. Well, that's because of the credit crunch. Because it's hard to get a mortgage, that's because of the mortgage crunch. But they basically mean the same thing.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Another question I have for you, that, you know, with gas prices being as high as they are, what do we do when our money is funny? What is there to do? Is there any way around, are there any tips that you can provide us that would help us to access or to find or to discover some monies that we already have?
Wow. Well, the first thing, Anna, which people hear all the time, but I'm just saying is probably more important today than it's ever been, and that's getting on a budget. Because, you know, when money is flowing in our lives, for most of us, we're kind of loose with it. But when times get tight, you start watching every penny. And I'm just saying we have to watch every penny. When we go shopping, we have to look at coupons. We have to look at specials. We need to start looking in the newspaper for different sales. We need to, school is starting for a lot of kids now. And, you know, buying those expensive tennis shoes and, you know, these labels, fancy labels. Everybody has to make personal choices about the quality of what they buy. So that's an individual thing. I would say, secondly, it's just some real practical stuff. I mean, cutting back on eating out, cutting back on going to movies, cutting back on everything, going out to lunch, you know, making your lunch at home, how you use your electricity. All these little bitty things. Do you really need 300 channels on your cable TV? Can you just go with basic cable?
Rent a movie from what's those kiosks at Walmart the Walgreens, the grocery store. And I don't know if our listeners have discovered them yet, but I just discovered them this weekend. I had guests, so we rented 3 movies from Blockbuster that cost me about $16.
Wow.
Then I went over to Walmart. The same 3 movies would have cost me $3.
Incredible.
I need some eggs.
I know that's right. Wow. But there's so many things like the way we drive our car for gasoline. You can't drive. The faster you go, the more gas is going to eat up. So
slow down.
Yeah, slow down. How about this? If your city has public transportation, you need to, you know, maybe a couple of days a week, take public transportation if you can. Just thinking of all kind of little things. I hate to say this, Anna, but it's the kind of stuff that many of us have taken for granted, and now we can't take it for granted anymore. And so we just finding money. There are multiple ways to do that. I mean, the deductibles we have on our insurance policies and stuff may need to be higher. Therefore, the monthly or quarterly payment could be lower. They're just all kind of things we could do.
Well, you know, we also have our guests. We have several guests that are actually listening in, and Michelle and I she's one of the guests that's listening to the show on the Internet, and we were laughing when we were talking about those movies, and she was laughing out loud, and then you talked about, you know, public transportation. I said, now I'm going to slow down, but I ain't getting on no bus.
You're not getting on the bus.
No, I'm not getting on the bus, man. I'm going to slow down that vehicle.
Oh, I know.
I don't know
right about
riding the bus in this 102-degree weather here in Texas.
Well,
and I certainly feel sorry for any others who have to ride a bus, but I do understand that that's certainly valuable.
That's right. And in some cities like Atlanta, we have MARTA. I believe in the San Francisco area, it's BART, I believe. You know, these transit systems, and those are pretty convenient. You know, of course, in New York City, the subways are primarily how people get around.
Sure.
So as long as it's safe, you have to consider it.
Yes, and certainly, and I certainly agree with that. Now, let's talk about renting versus buying. In this economy, is this a buyer's market or a seller's market, or should we be renting? What's the difference in these? Is it better to buy or rent a place to live?
Well, this is a buyer's market. My God, this is a buyer's market. If somebody is ready to buy a home, there's good and a bad. The good part is you could get a good deal like never before. You can talk people down. You can come in and negotiate great. The tough part is getting the actual mortgage loan. If you don't have stellar credit, it's going to be a little tougher to get the loan. So the question of renting versus buying in the long run is better to buy in the long run for most people. However, if a person is renting right now, I think that this housing thing could continue for the next 6 to 12 months. So if you're renting and you're not financially prepared to buy a house, go ahead and keep renting, getting yourself together, because those deals will still be available. And sometimes renting is more appropriate, because just because you can pay the mortgage doesn't mean you can afford the house, because you got repairs, you got insurance type stuff. So just make sure you can afford the house. You've got taxes and all those kind of things. So which is better, renting or buying? Long run, buying. Short run, for a lot of people, particularly in this economy, renting.
So do you also, I guess it would also be very difficult, because we've talked about the credit crunch or the mortgage crunch, it would also be very difficult for individuals to refinance, because many of the issues are those loans that were done at adjustable rate mortgages that are now coming due, and then now we can't find credit for it. So what does a person do in a situation like that?
Wow. That's a tough situation. What do you do? You beg the company, literally, that you are with to refinance or restructure your loan. And sometimes you have to be a little dramatic. I'm not saying people ought to lie and overly exaggerate, but if the terms are that bad, you have to say, look here, ABC Mortgage Company, if you all can't help me, then I may have trouble keeping this home. And you know what? If I foreclose ABC Mortgage Company, you all are going to get left with this. Can you all please help me to restructure it? I will tell you this, Anna, people are more open. And the government, there are some government laws that have been passed that people are more open to restructuring mortgages than they've ever been, because so many people have been walking away from these mortgages, and now they're really getting stuck. So I would say, will it work? I can't say it will work every time, Anna, but I am saying that this is the time to beg, to plead, and to play the card. And I mean doing this with integrity by saying, hey, if y'all can't help me, we're going to have some problems here.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we've been listening and hearing about certainly some of those the laws or some of the relief that Congress is talking about. Are you familiar with any of that information and how it might help individuals? Also, there was also the Hope Fund or something about that was supposed to be able to help give relief to mortgage owners?
I'm not as familiar as I should be on that. I really need to read up a little bit more about it. But I am saying that the mortgage people are very familiar with it. And so I would just suggest that that if somebody Googled mortgage relief, they will find, because it's a lot more than what I even have time to explain here on the show, but there are probably 10 to 12 different scenarios that a person could find themselves in that would be covered under this relief package. Now, that doesn't mean all your problems are going to go away. It just means that the mortgage companies are more open to hearing your story and working with you.
All right. Now, we're going into our college season, and many parents are sending their children to college. And what are some of the best ways that this is a two-part question. First part of the question is, what are some of the ways that families can begin to prepare for students who are going to college? How can they save for it? Then the second part of the question is, what can a family do if they have not prepared for securing their children's tuition?
Yeah. Well, the best scenario is to, when your children are young, start putting away a couple of $100, a couple of $1,000, whatever, on a monthly or quarterly basis, because you have time working for you. And the less you, it doesn't take a lot of money if you're saving over 15 or 16 or 17 or 18 years. The closer that child gets to college, the more money you're going to have to put away. So what happens a lot is life happens, meaning that things happen in life, and we look up, next thing we know, our daughter or our son is in the 11th grade. They're in the 12th grade. They're in the 10th grade, and we hadn't put anything away. So people who find themselves in that situation, first of all, it's still not too late to put some money away. You just shouldn't put it in anything very risky. Secondly, there is an incredible plan called a 529 plan. It's a state-sponsored college funding plan. You can put money in it, and you can take it out tax-free. You can even get a state tax deduction on some states, and it's a real good way to put money away for college education if the money is used for college. But here's the reality, Anna. A lot of people just haven't prepared, and they need to look at different types of student loans and scholarships and everything that they can find. They need to look at it. And there is a website that is a very good website. I think it's called College411. I'm looking for it. I got my little computer here. Yeah, there are some websites. Well, there's a good website called SavingForCollege.com. Saving for College. Pretty simple. And then there's another one called College411. And so bottom line, scholarships, if a kid qualifies for it, or parent loans, or student loans if you haven't saved enough money.
All right. We have a caller that's calling in from the 804 area code, and we're going to welcome you to the show. I have my guest here, Lee Jenkins, who is the author of What to Do When My Money is Funny. So caller from 804.
Yes.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's Michelle.
Hi, Michelle. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. I was calling in because I'm listening to your show. I'm a financial planner, so I love listening to money. So, and I need to go out and get your book, Lee, because it sounds like it's something that I can use and show my clients when I'm talking to them. So,
yes, thank
you. I was listening to you about your college savings plans and the cutting costs. I also told Anna about the Coverdell IRA, where
yes.
You can put money in. I think it's $2,000, and if your child is in a private school, then you can start pulling the money out when they're in kindergarten through 12th grade.
Oh, that's awesome!
But the other thing I wanted to just kind of talk to you about cutting costs, because I talk to my clients all the time about cutting costs. And people say to, let your hair go gray, because,
that's not going to happen, Michelle. Look, I got a bunch of gray hair, but you see what color that hair is on that picture, don't you?
It looks very good. Very good. Uh-huh. And it's all, because we have always been trying our best to, just spend our money, and United States is hard on savings. We do not save. So we're just so used to spending money, we're looking at ourselves now, we're saying, what do we do? So that's one thing that I can say, and play golf less or everything.
Oh, no, come on, Michelle. Are you reading my bio or something? That I play golf.
No, I have not.
I dye my hair. And this is just not going to work out. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, then you can go to the public ranges, but not the private ones. So,
I'll make that concession.
Okay. And another one is, and I always tell this to my clients, is that when they are trying to start a business, before they stop working their full-time job, go out and get all the business credit cards and all the business loans that you can. Because when you stop working, you don't have a leg to stand on. So when you are doing your business, you're doing your business part time, you're able to say, hey, I need a credit card, and your credit is good, and you will keep your credit great after you get your business. But if you quit your job and try to do this, it won't work. Trust me, I've been there. So I always tell that to people who are trying to start a business, is to make sure that everything, your business plan is together and everything is done, so that you won't be struggling trying to get a loan or struggling trying to get a credit card.
Oh, that's awesome.
Good.
Well, thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle. Great advice.
Girl. I'll be calling you up. I think I got one more show. No. But I'm going to be calling you up. And this is such great advice. It's just a wonderful opportunity to be able to share information. And by the way, let me just tell the people, you're listening to Anna the Real McCoy on Woman Act Now Radio, and it's all about execution and really helping people to begin to execute on their ideas. So, again, Michelle, thank you so much for listening and sharing. And don't hesitate to call us at any time.
Oh, well, I'll put you on my favorites list.
I thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right, dear.
Bye-bye.
So, Lee?
Yes.
I want you to take a moment and share with our listeners how they can get in touch with you, where they can get your book,
okay,
and any other information. If you're going to be speaking in an area in the next couple of weeks or months, what your current speaking schedule may be, so that we can share you. Lee is such an awesome gift, and he's just a wonderful man of humility and we love him, and we want you to love him, and we want you to have an experience with him. So tell him how to reach you, Lee.
Well, thank you, Anna, for that, those kind words. The best way to reach me is to go on my website, www.leejenkins.org. That's L-E-E, Lee, Jenkins, J-E-N-K-I-N-S, .org. Not .com, that's another Lee Jenkins, but .org. And on that website, you'll see a couple of things. You'll see some very helpful tools and some articles, but you'll also see my schedule, where I'll be, and if it's anywhere near you, I would definitely recommend that you drop in on one of my seminars or teachings. And if you want to email me, you will be able to find my email address on the website, and I can answer questions via telephone or email. And lastly, if you want to get my book, they are at most Christian bookstores, as well as Barnes & Nobles. And many times if you go in a store and they don't have it, it's in their computer, and they can order it for you and have it within a day or two.
Well, I see Michelle says she's getting her book. I don't blame you, girl. I get my book. But I want you to tell them about the previous book you wrote as well on, what was it called?
Taking Care of Business. Yeah.
Taking Care of Business. Tell them about that book for a moment.
Well, my first book, as Anna said, was Taking Care of Business. And it's a book about finances from a biblical perspective. But what makes this book different is I deal with the cultural issues as it relates to the African-American culture, because we're 13% of the population. We only own 1% of the wealth. We're 13% of the population, but we buy 40% almost of luxury cars and vodka and cigarettes, and there are just some astounding statistics that I try to deal with to help deal with this wealth disparity between blacks and other cultures. Half of black people have bad credit versus only 34% of Hispanics and 24% of whites. So the first book is about managing money, but I also deal with some of the cultural issues and the cultural challenges that we have had for generations as black people.
So I wanted to make sure that you understood that we're dealing with a man of substance. How long have you been in the financial industry, Lee?
21 years. That's hard to believe.
That's almost as old as long as I am old. I'm just as old.
That's right, Anna. You're just in your mid-20s.
I've been taking my regular juice on a daily basis, and I feel like I'm getting younger every day.
I know what you mean.
My little vitamins and everything. But let me ask you this question. Tell us about, from your business, okay, the speaking is wonderful, but I also want people to understand that you are also a financial planner, registered advisor.
Yeah.
I'm laughing at you, Michelle, saying that you're 19. Okay, all right. You sound like you was 19 with all that knowledge you got.
Yeah, but, yeah, too much knowledge.
Yes, tell them what your business, what do you do in business?
Well, for the last 21 years, I have been a registered investment advisor. I have my own firm in Atlanta called Jenkins Wealth Advisors. And basically what we are a financial planning and advisory firm, and we manage money for institutions and individuals. We manage their investment portfolios. We do stocks, bonds, mutual funds, things like that. Our typical client has at least $100,000 or more, but not all of them, but that's our typical client. And basically we try to grow people's wealth to meet some of their needs, like retirement, kids' education, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that's what I've been doing for 21 years. I speak, I write, and I manage investments for clients all over the nation.
Okay. You hear that, people? Now, we're going to talk about one thing, well, a couple of things before I let you go. We've got a few minutes on our show, and you're listening to Anna, the Real McCoy on Woman Act Now Radio, teaching women how to execute on their dreams, ideas, and opportunities. But this is one question is, I want to understand, can you speak to, just for a few minutes, of how should individuals be handling their 401ks right now in the marketplace?
Wow, great question, and a tough question to answer. And the reason I say that is because most people look at their statements right now, and it's ugly, and it's probably been ugly for the last few quarters. And what a lot of folks do is they start putting stuff back in something really, really safe. And, hey, which is not bad, but the problem is what happens when the market turns around. So here's what I would suggest to people do. Make sure you're diversified. Have some bond funds in the portfolio. Have some small-cap mutual funds. Have some mid-cap mutual funds. Have some large-cap mutual funds. Have some international. Make sure, maybe even some REIT funds or real estate funds. Make sure that you are spread out significantly, and it wouldn't hurt to have some bonds, something that's really stable. But what I would not do is to change the whole portfolio to something ultra-conservative, because that's just not a wise thing to do unless you're getting ready to retire in the next couple of years.
Now, you know, Lee, a few years ago back in, I believe that was in the year 2000, 2001, 2002, we also had a dip in the stock market where our 401ks took a major hit, and many of them have never recovered. So you sure we should be keeping our money there? I mean, is it going to come back around? I mean, is it just...
Well, actually, the market did recover. It's just that in 2000...
Why didn't get my money back, Lee? I'm still looking for my money. You know what I mean?
Well,
it must have recovered around me because, you know what, I got to the point, you know, it didn't even open up the 401k envelope. You know what I mean?
Know.
You knew it was nothing there.
Oh, my God. It was ugly.
Saying, keep your money in a 401k. Keep your money there.
That's right. Well, here's what happened. We had 2000 was a negative year, 2001, 2002. Okay, 3 years, people lost a bunch of money. But
yes.
2003, 2004, 2005, and 2006, and I could be wrong, it might have been 2004, 5, 6. And
I think
so,
you're right, because I started to see mine starting taking another dive, Lee, taking another dive. But I did do pretty well in those 2004, 2005, maybe a little bit of 2003.
That's right. But here's the problem. People got so scared after 9/11 that they put it in something safe. And what happened when the market started to go back up, they were still in all that safe stuff, and they didn't experience the increase. And so here's the bottom line, Anna. I think people need to hedge their bets. Keep some of it, depending on your age, in some fairly aggressive things like stock mutual funds, and keep some of it in some conservative things. Never try to bet the farm on either extreme. And that's what gets people in trouble, because if you're wrong, you're going to get hurt. If you put it all in stocks saying, hey, this is the bottom, well, it may not be the bottom. But if you put it all in bonds or something safe and you say, it's going to get worse, it's going to get worse, well, suppose it gets better. Then you've just lost out on the upside. Hedge your bets, and that's really what a person needs to do.
Well, all right, Lee, I want you to know that we're certainly pleased to have you as our guest today. We don't have enough time, because I certainly did want to ask you about that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac stuff going on right now, but I'm going to have to save that for another show.
Okay, well, I'd love to come back.
But we will definitely have you back with the information. Again, you can reach Lee Jenkins at leejenkins.org. reach out. The name of his book is What to Do When Your Money is Funny. And Lee, again, we want to thank you for joining us. And you've been listening to Anna, the Real McCoy, on Woman Act Now Radio. And this is the place where we're all about helping women to execute on their ideas, execute on their lifestyle, their finances, their business, their relationships. So, again, I'd like to thank all of our listeners for listening to the show today, and please join us again on next Thursday. In fact, next Thursday, I want to let you know it will not be live. It will be pre-recorded because I am in, and I won't be available to do no live show. But anyway, I want to talk to you soon. Have a great day, and know that you're loved and appreciated. Signing off, Anna the Real McCoy.
You know you need to get control of your finances, but like many people, you probably don't know where to start. That's why Anna McCoy and her husband Richmond have created a plan of action they call Building Generational Wealth. This easy-to-follow workbook contains step-by-step instructions that will enable you to understand and act to secure your financial future. You'll learn how to determine your net worth.